It's time once again for Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 5 years has shared with us her extensive research into political assassinations and abuses of power in this country. Her program relates the news of the week to emerging evidence about the conspiracy which allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative, executive, and judicial processes in America. And now, Mae Brussel.
This is October the 18th, 1976, and this is Dialogue Conspiracy number 239. I have been receiving telephone calls at the House and requests in the mail at the home to talk about the elections that are coming up, and I promised I would talk about Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford, and I have a lot of hesitancy on the subject. I have strong feelings about this election, but I kind of avoided this kind of comment because I'm always so distressed at the choices of candidates, and this has been going on for so long. Maybe I'm just not realistic enough as to what the electoral process is all about. I still have a certain amount of optimism or opinion of the kind of person I would like to see be president of the United States, and I think a lot of other people do, too. I think 50% of the voters aren't going to vote at all, and the apathy shows that people do have strong feelings about the candidates, and they don't even want to bother in this next election. I'm going to talk about Gerald Ford. I'll talk about Jimmy Carter and try to match them up even for even and not pick on one more than the other. Of course, my objection to Gerald Ford has to do with his being on the Warren Commission. There's no way that I could vote for him as president of the United States because he not only was appointed to the Warren Commission by Richard Nixon, but I've studied the killing of John Kennedy for almost 13 years now, and Gerald Ford was an active participant in the cover-up. And I don't see any difference between what he did and what Richard Nixon did at Watergate. As a matter of fact, I think it was worse because Nixon, at least up to this point, hasn't been charged with murders, and I think murders took place in that electoral incident from 1968 to 72. But Gerald Ford actually deprived us of the electoral process because when that assassination was done and the cover-up was complete, it allowed then the shooting of Robert Kennedy or George Wallace or the killing of Mary Jo Kopechne. The theme of cover-up was followed in every election and will continue unless this pattern of killing our leaders isn't exposed. And Gerald Ford used his position in the House of Representatives to write a book called The Portrait of the Assassin. And it was not only a false book about Lee Harvey Oswald, it was a very misconstrued book with quotations of people who from the intelligence community that worked with the defense industry and NASA and the military intelligence. And he used the testimony of these witnesses that was perjury and outright lies and couldn't be matched to the real evidence or documentation that existed. So he wrote a book to keep the history, again, held down, and then the pattern of Lee Harvey Oswald could be put into the profile of Sirhan Sirhan or Arthur Brimmer or James Earl Ray. And, of course, all these cases are going to be opened up. But Gerald Ford was part of the master cover-up, so that anything I say about Jimmy Carter today or my feelings about him, I don't want to misconstrue that I don't want him to be my selection for president, being as we have only those two choices. I'll say at the beginning and at the end that I think there's a lot of problems with Jimmy Carter, but there's no way that I could vote for Gerald Ford as a member of the Warren Commission. It seems funny that this gentleman is running for president of the United States. He was appointed by Nixon when the Congress just voted 280 to 65 to open up the investigation of the murder of John Kennedy. And that includes also the murder of Reverend Martin Luther King. But at the time that Congress is voting to open up this murder, nobody campaigning dares mention the fact that Gerald Ford had a part of covering it up that made it so horrendous. So, you see, the issues do not come to the people. Good hard issues don't come out. And once in a while, Fritz Mondale talks about Watergate. Very seldom does Jimmy Carter. And they want your confidence. They talk about the apathy of the voter, and not one of them brings up the subject of Congress voting 280 to 65 at this late date to open the Kennedy assassination that the opponent of Jimmy Carter was part of the original cover-up. I will in another week or two go at length into the committee that's formed back in Washington, D.C. But while I'm mentioning it, I think it's interesting to know that of the members of the House of Representatives who were against opening the investigation of John Kennedy, one was Samuel L. Devine of Ohio. He voted no to the resolution to open up the investigation of the murders. And as soon as this had passed in the House of Representatives, he was put on the 12-man panel to investigate the murders. He was against doing it, and he was put on. Another gentleman, Bert Talcott, didn't vote in the House of Representatives on this issue. He wasn't present on this controversial issue, and he was put as one of the 12 men. And Representative Yvonne Burke from California was among the 84 that didn't vote at all, like Bert Talcott, and she was put on the panel. So two people from that panel didn't show up at all to vote, and one voted against the resolution. And they're supposed to go into this case that Mr. Sprague has said will be handled like a homicide. He wants to stick with the facts of the murder and handle it like a homicide. Well, when you investigate a homicide, the panel are objective. They don't start with an opinion already formulated. And being as these people either vote against it, and Mr. Talcott has said that he's going to prove there was no conspiracy or put it to rest, something to that effect, it's interesting that they're on this committee. But from the 280 who voted to open up the murders, how many people in the Congress of those 280 say, number one, we want to find out who killed John Kennedy, and number two, we want Gerald Ford for president? It seems a little ridiculous to be voting Gerald Ford in as president at the same time that you're going to go over the material and the minutes of the Warren Commission meetings that Gerald Ford was at, where he obviously and covered up and made a very concerted effort to keep the truth from the American people. Now, the other side of the coin is there's no reason to believe that Jimmy Carter or Fritz Mondale have ever publicly made any opinion on not only the attack of Gerald Ford, but on the Warren Commission or the Kennedy killings. I heard from somebody inside the Carter campaign that he would be in favor of continuing the investigation of the murders, but I've never heard him say it, and maybe you've heard it or read it somewhere. If you have, sent me the article, but I've never heard it. So when you talk about credibility or voters' apathy or loss of confidence in government or wasting taxpayers' money, I think that you have to go back to these murders and realize that a lot has happened to this country that could be solved if we hit into the electoral process and the continuous murders. And yet the people running for office don't even bring it up at all. Now, Andrew Young is the black member of Congress from Georgia who's worked very hard with Jimmy Carter and his campaign. And Jimmy Carter claims that he really owes his presidential campaign nomination success to Andrew Young. He praises him all the time. And Andrew Young's picture was in People magazine last week as the up-and-coming black politician. And yet Andrew Young was with Martin Luther King at the time that he was killed, and Martin Luther King was out on the balcony. And Andrew Young has been part of holding back the investigation of the Martin Luther King assassination. His congressional aide was out in Carmel last summer to see me with no interest in that conspiracy at all. And there's even been some mention about Andrew Young being responsible for the moving from the Holiday into the Lorraine Motel that Martin Luther King did just before he was murdered. He abstained from the vote in Congress that Andrew Young did on whether or not to open up the Martin Luther King assassination. And the issue was very clear. Did the FBI, the CIA, or the Memphis police have a part in the actual planning of the murder of Martin Luther King or in the cover-up? And Martin Luther King was a great civil rights leader, Nobel Peace winner. I think he's head and shoulders above anything that Mr. Andrew Young ever did up till now in any respect that a presidential candidate says he owes his nomination to this man, which indicates to me that once more the name in Washington of the game is kill or cover up, promote, more kill, more cover up, more promote. It seems to me at a time like this that Andrew Young, who is supposed to become an up-and-coming leader, might at least have been there to vote at the House of Representatives, yes, yay, open it up, wanting to know who killed his friend on the balcony the day that he was there. unless Andrew Young is a Judas of this crowd of the Martin Luther King assassination. And if that's true, and if he's very buddy-buddy with Jimmy Carter, I have reason then to have less respect for Jimmy Carter and Andrew Young, and I don't consider them political leaders that I want to follow. Now, the killing of Martin Luther King, Reverend Martin Luther King, was a political matter. It wasn't just a black man, an American. It wasn't just a civil rights leader. We're talking about an election year. And right after James Earl Ray was arrested, he said that the people that he met with who caused him to become a patsy told him that this had to be done in an election year. And the killing of King in May 68 led to riots in Detroit and Washington and Los Angeles. And these riots gave us Spiro Agnew. I've written about that in my Realist article. There's a linear connection between Agnew, who now travels between the Greek military junta that are temporarily out of office, and between Iran and Kuwait, and Nazi Minutemen and racist foundation he has in Indiana. Spiro Agnew came to be known in Maryland as governor at the time that Martin Luther King was murdered, and he had press conferences, and he was attacking Ramp Brown and Stokely Carmichael and others. So he was a relative unknown until Martin Luther King was murdered. And I think that with his close affinity to the Nazis now and to racist organizations, it would be of interest to find out if there were connections between provocateurs that caused those riots and so forth and the murder of Martin Luther King. So Andrew Young is not taking a position on this. And as I say, he refused to vote about it. And he's very, very close to Jimmy Carter. This apathy that goes on in Washington has a lot to do with that invisible government that I talk about all the time, the Howard Hughes empire, whoever they are or wherever they are, and their desire to control the White House or the Supreme Court and the district attorneys and the Congress and the sheriffs and mayors and supervisors and the highway commissions. And the Congress is reduced then when people pay their campaign expenses and out-of-state money runs there. Political campaigns are reduced to voting or staying away on controversial issues such as this. And we'll go a little more into who might be funding Andrew Young. I feel that the apathy that we feel at election time is described in a poem by Robinson Jeffers. It was in our paper just Sunday on the Purse Seine. It was a poem about a school of sardine fish that were swimming out in the Monterey Santa Cruz Bay. And as the fish nets came around them, they knew they were caught, and they were beating wildly from one wall to the other as their destiny closed in. And Robinson Jeffers went on to say, "We've built great cities now, but there's no escape. We gather vast populations incapable of free survival, and we're insulated from the strong earth, and each person is himself helpless." I think it's that feeling of helplessness and being gathered or caught in a net that he referred to as drawing narrower and closer that has kept people just indifferent about whether they vote or not. They feel that this net is closing in on them, and they don't even want to bother to register. Now, the one reason for voting for Jimmy Carter that I can see the strongest reason, possibly the strongest, I guess, is the decision of who would be on the Supreme Court for the years to come. Because when the election is over, the next 30 or 40 years of the decisions of the Supreme Court affects our lives. And it's more important even than the election of the president is who he would vote for. And I can't imagine that Jimmy Carter, with all of his faults, whatever they are, and there are plenty, would appoint justices equal to the ones that Richard Nixon did or Gerald Ford if he gets the opportunity. Now, even the other side of the coin is I'm not sure. Maybe he would appoint Leon Jaworski on the Supreme Court just as Gerald Ford would do. I don't see any indication that Jimmy Carter would be more enlightened on this matter. I know that he defended the Supreme Court, Nixon's Supreme Court, recently. He said they were going in the right direction and they were doing a good job. And yet the Supreme Court has been the most fascist type of court, denying certain civil liberties like the right to protect your reputation and the allowance of prosecuting attorneys to use perjured testimony, even at the time they know it's perjured, if they can get a strong conviction. Now, with the Supreme Court making those kind of decisions and Jimmy Carter going along with them, I'm not really sure who he would appoint on the Supreme Court. And he doesn't give any indication, of course, where his mentality is on that matter. The vice presidential choice, I think there's a big difference. I think whether Representative Dole is vice president or Mondale is vice president is important. Mondale consistently has voted for what I think are the best things in America. He's offered suggestions for housing and for health and ecology, and I feel that he's a fairly decent human being. The minus side for Mondale is his links to the Bilderberg Society and David Rockefeller and these secret organizations that meet, and the press can't get into these meetings and nobody knows what's going on. They're run by Lockheed and the CIA and the wealthiest corporations in America. And also the Trilateral Committee. Mondale and Carter were the selections for a committee formed in 72 to have an opposing party to the Republican Party as it exists. And they created this Democratic Party out of their own imagination. And Rockefeller isn't running for any office, but he and the Chase Manhattan Bank and the Eastern Group have put in Jimmy Carter to serve their purposes. And when you see Mr. Kissinger traveling around and making deals at various countries, we're not sure exactly what their purposes are. We've seen in the last years with Henry Kissinger and the White House in operation, the military dictatorships that have been put into power. And I have an article this week. It was from the Salt Lake Tribune, a quotation from the New York News. And Jack Anderson had another one about the military coups that have come in power. Thailand last week and South Korea, the Philippines, Peru, Ecuador, Panama, El Salvador, Uruguay, Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua, the Dominican Republic. If this is the best that America has to offer to keep putting on these military dictatorships, then it's very dangerous to have the Trilateral Commission of the Bilderberg Society deciding what man will run the country next. And that's about what it's boiled down to. Now, Jimmy Carter is elected and killed. Mondale's a pretty decent guy, and I feel more secure with Gerald Ford choosing Robert Dole. I did some program on that after the conventions, the fact that not having Ronald Reagan as vice president or John Conley as vice president or Howard Baker was a little bit of hope, a little gleam of hope. I settle for not very much, but I think that gives Mr. Ford a better choice of life insurance. I don't say that those men mentioned would have a part of murdering them, but I think their powers so strong that if Gerald Ford had taken any one of those men for vice president, we would be sure that he would be murdered or step out of office. And this way, I think with Mr. Dole in, the chances are less that he will be murdered or have an accident or be assassinated. I remember Lyndon Johnson coming strong for a great society and domestic programs and pledges of civil rights improvement, the way that Fritz Mondale has stressed the domestic issues. But then as soon as Lyndon Johnson was in power, he escalated the war in Vietnam, and they made the ammunition makers and the war makers were making $1 million an hour, I believe, was the budget for the Vietnam War. So the domestic programs were still curtailed, and the provisions, the housing for the poor and the health plans and all the goodies were scaled down, and they still are, so that the warfare state would get the first choice of the budget. So domestic concerns can be put aside at a moment, and even though Fritz Mondale has voted very well on domestic issues, I'm not sure what would happen if we needed another war. He'd put the domestic aside to, quote, save America, I suppose. The country was torn apart by the Vietnam War, and Lyndon Johnson's efforts for a domestic program, as I say, had to be put aside. Hubert Humphrey is a person that I have never respected. He, again, was strong domestically, domestic programs, but he went along as Vice President Lyndon Johnson and with the warfare state. And there were rumors that he received at least $50,000 from Howard Hughes' empire, and goodness knows if there was more than that through hidden funds. And Fritz Mondale was linked to Hubert Humphrey. He was the man who was appointed into the Congress in the first place. He didn't win by election. And he received the funding. He helped with the funding of Hubert Humphrey's campaigns, which means then that the Howard Hughes money went into Mondale's hands before it went to Humphrey. And I think that the Humphrey-Mondale money should have been investigated thoroughly to see whether the Hughes empire was funding these men so we know who's running for office and we know how they got there. If the money came hidden from the Hughes people, then Mondale and Humphrey or Carter are still getting their money through the Hughes Foundation. you know, the saying, if you go to bed with a dog, you wake up with fleas. And if you go to bed with dirty money and bribes and payoff, you wake up with a Congress that doesn't really represent the people. So I'm worried about the Humphrey Mondale money and Fritz Mondale's links to Bilderberger and the Trilateral. And I just wonder if his consistent voting record is really in keeping with the background of Fritz Mondale. And how would we know until he gets into office? It's like Hubert Humphrey giving the liberal line and coming in the House of Representatives as a liberal to get the Democratic vote. And then going along with the war in Vietnam constantly. And when Lyndon Johnson was dead and the war was over, saying, I didn't really believe in the war. Or Senator Schweiger, the same thing. Voting liberal, representing Pennsylvania and the constituents. And then when Ronald Reagan wanted him for vice president, he says, well, I always got along with Reagan. I'm sympathetic to everything Ronald Reagan did. And his liberal stance was washed down the drain. And for 3 weeks, he became a staunch conservative. And now I don't think he knows where he is. And he's having an identity problem. And I think Hubert Humphrey's having the same problem. But Fritz Mondale is so closely linked to Hubert Humphrey that the used money would have to rub off on him. And because he does go to the countries with the trilateral work, like in Holland with Prince Bernhard and Japan, Lockheed scandals in both countries being hushed up, how do we know who's behind Jimmy Carter and Fritz Mondale? And how do we know what they will do once they're in office? Now, Vice President Robert Dole, his record is pretty open. He doesn't have much to offer, and he doesn't have much to hide. I don't really think he's part of the very secret team that the Republicans had. He doesn't have much in personality, and I don't think he's got programs that necessarily would help this country at all. But he's been around for a long time, and you can look at his voting record. You know what you're getting. He's not a great mystery, and for all purposes, I don't think he was part of those secret meetings overseas, or if he was, it hasn't been published or publicized that he attended these secret meetings. He doesn't have any glamour, and he doesn't have a program. But his life is pretty open, and I almost feel, you know, it's a toss-up there. I know that the Howard Hughes money also goes into the Republican side, into Richard Nixon and Robert Dole. But the bulk of it in the last elections went to Robert Mullen Associates and into the committee to reelect the president. And they kept the espionage money, the secret espionage money, out of the Republican money, and Dole was in charge of the Republican money. And for that reason, he appears not to be as tainted as he could be if CREEP was under his headquarters or organization, which it wasn't. Now, the mentality of the candidates, if I'm sounding vague or wishy-washy, I am really not enhanced any more than the 50% of the people that aren't going to vote. But getting back to the mentality of the candidates, Jimmy Carter is big conversation on the news media because of his Playboy campaign. He talks about lusting for women and shacking up and screwing. And this is kind of funny language for him to be having. A friend of mine called me, and she felt concerned that Carter's control of lust was based upon the good Lord, and when you talk directly to God, you have emotional problems and you're not stable. And I think that that's makes sense. And every time you see a woman and the good Lord has to tell you, cut it off or you'll get in trouble, I wonder if he had electrode implants. Jimmy Carter's closest friend is a psychiatrist by the name of Byrne, who's literally managed his campaign for the last 5 years. And I think of these transponders that I've talked about that are inserted surgically into the bodies of persons to control their sexual desires or emotions. And I wonder if Jimmy Carter will have a transponder put in him so that there won't be any blackmail in the White House. If he sees a pretty girl, the satellite can tell him to get it down and not carry on. Maybe his mind is affecting his lust, and it's not the God. Maybe it's a psychiatrist. But it's funny language, and the election is just a week or two off, and people are reading the Playboy article. And I think the language is unnecessary. And I don't know why the women's movement haven't objected. If he said that he was concerned about seeing the girls shacking up or screwing the girls, the women's movement would be frantic. When they use the word women and not girls, the language doesn't seem to make any difference, and nobody's making too much fuss about that. But then Gerald Ford's having a different problem. Gerald Ford's having a problem of knowing where he is, and that's equally bad as having the Lord talk to you about your sexual desires. And I think this is pretty serious. I was reading yesterday's paper, Gerald Ford went to Lincoln, Illinois this week, and he began to give a speech. He says, it's great to be in Pontiac, Michigan, which was two stops before, and he wasn't aware that he was in Illinois. Then later, they made a stop, and he said, Betty and I celebrated our 28th anniversary last night up in Joliet, Indiana. And they actually had been in Illinois, and he was telling them that he was in Indiana, sharing that with them. Then he went to Iowa State University last week, and he gave a speech, and he said, it's great to be in Ohio. And it turned out that he was actually speaking at Ames, Iowa. And he gave another speech in Michigan. He said, we Michiganders have the Ohio State on our mind. And he actually wasn't in Michigan at the time he was talking. And then he gave another speech to an audience, and he said he spent the night in Lawton, Texas, and he actually been in Oklahoma. Now, that may sound kind of funny, but what if they tell him there's a war going on in Nicaragua and he presses a button for South Korea? Is the guy really had? Does he know what he's doing? I mean, you know, this is not normal. The falling down the steps and bumping into trees or getting hit by an elevator or having a car almost run into him and being hit with an American flag and a list of about 20 casualties in the last year and a half aren't very funny, and I'm really suspicious about those. But I think this having a name problem is serious, and I don't know what it means. I remember the group of behavior modification group that came into the White House just before Richard Nixon's tapes were revealed by Alex and Butterfield, and they had a behavior modification team in the White House. I don't know what it means to not know where he is, but I think it's highly unusual, and I don't think it's funny at all. It was on a wire service story yesterday. Well, in terms of warfare state, I think that Jimmy Carter seems just as gung-ho as Gerald Ford, and I don't think we can afford to be that way at this time. I think of the tree incident in Korea just at the time of the conventions, Republican conventions of this last summer. Gerald Ford was consulted before that tree was cut down in Korea, South Korea. Airplanes were overhead and cameras were taking pictures. And Gerald Ford just won the nomination, and this incident came down where two American soldiers were killed in the UN zone, in the neutral zone, and a tree was cut down. Well, Jimmy Carter was interviewed the next morning when he got off the airplane, and Gerald Ford had sent troops in. He spent about $2 million in 1 week with the B-52s and the bombers and got very angry and responded like he did at the Mayaguez incident. Gerald Ford seems to need this macho, hard-on-communist line. So as soon as he was appointed president of the United States, 41 people were killed at the time of the Mayaguez incidents. And this Rockefeller did that at the time of Attica. He called in the troops and became the darling of the more conservative Republicans after he ordered the guards and the prisoners killed at Attica. But Jimmy Carter got off the airplane right after the tree incidents, and the news people asked him what he thought of that incident. And he was very much in accord with Gerald Ford. He said, I agree with what he did or his stance or strong stance. Now, what would my feelings be about this in the terms of a candidate that I would want for president? I would have preferred that Jimmy Carter, at the time of the interview, said, I will wait on the opinion till all the facts are in. He hadn't been briefed on it yet. He could have said, I remember the loss of lives at the time of the Mayaguez, and we acted too fast. The men probably would have been allowed to live. He could have said, I remember the Gulf of Tonkin incident, where the CIA gave the wrong information, and the war escalated in Southeast Asia, and approximately 45,000 Americans, in addition to all the Vietnamese that were murdered, proceeded because of the Gulf of Tonkin incidents. I would like Jimmy Carter to say, if I were president, I would avoid a conflict beforehand because you can always go into it later, and I would allow the UN to evaluate it. They had soldiers there, and I'll study the tree-chopping incident and see what we can do about it. The whole thing dropped very quickly, and it was much ado about nothing. And I think the North Koreans were able to prove that there was positive provocation, that they warned a week before that something was going to happen and that they were teased and that was timed with Gerald Ford's nomination. But Carter didn't have to go along with it, and I think his Annapolis background is similar to Gerald Ford's military-Navy background, and they're gung-ho, both of them, and there wasn't a bit of difference in their response. Now, on the television, the first debate, the night of the first debate, Gerald Ford was asked about the investigations of the FBI and the CIA, and he was allowed to give a full answer of his opinion about what happened in terms of investigating these agencies and what he would do in the future or were they under control. And when Jimmy Carter started to answer the question about the FBI and CIA, the power was cut off. I think, remember, it was 27 minutes, something like that, 17 or 27 minutes. And when they went back on the air, they went to another question and summary and summarized the issues. And I think that the exposure of the CIA and FBI and the crimes that they've committed is one of the number one problems in the country. I think this is what's bringing the apathy. This is why these men can only get 50% of the people out to vote or to get registered. And I think when the air time went back, that Jimmy Carter should have demanded equal time to Gerald Ford to say what he had to say about the FBI and CIA. If each of them had a 3-minute summary, that would be a 6-minute time before it was over, he should have asked for his time to answer that question that was cut off the air, and maybe each of them take a 2-minute summary or a minute and a half. I got a transcript of that question and answer section. In fact, it was printed in full in the Washington Post and the New York Times, and Jimmy Carter never did fully answer the question, and Gerald Ford had a chance to. And I would like to think that Jimmy Carter was something different than Gerald Ford, that he had guts or stamina, and that he could say, wait, my question was turned off. Ford got to answer his, and I couldn't answer mine. But he stood up there like a sloppy little milquetoast. How can you have confidence in a man like that who's just standing there and repeats something by rote and doesn't have enough imagination to say, the question was turned off when it was my turn, and I'm going to answer that question. Then we'll get on to the next. He didn't do that, and I think he's weak. And I think that allows the intelligence community to be protected by Jimmy Carter, and I don't like that at all. And furthermore, he approves of Mr. Bush of the CIA and protects the Central Intelligence Agency. It's interesting, Jimmy Carter's come out against activity of Mr. Kelly of the FBI and criticized him, but he praised George Bush, Director George Bush of the CIA, and entertained Mr. Bush in Plains, Georgia. And said he has great respect for the CIA. And yet, in the book Who's Who in the CIA, you see the description of Eugene McCarthy, and McCarthy's linked to CIA foundations. And McCarthy's pulling the rug out from Jimmy Carter, and Carter doesn't even have the guts to say, wait a minute, my campaign's being ruined by the CIA. Why would he praise Bush when the vote may be lost in this next election because Eugene McCarthy is doing his best to take votes away from Carter? It shows that Carter isn't any more a clear thinker than Gerald Ford not remembering where he is. If a man doesn't know who his enemies are and he praises the agency that sends in the goon squad to sabotage your election, what kind of decisions is he going to make in the future? How does he know who his friend is or his enemy is? He accepts the fact that he can lose the election by Eugene McCarthy stepping in, but refuses to attack Eugene McCarthy as being part of the CIA apparatus, even though there's many documents linking Eugene McCarthy to the CIA foundations and also the book Who's Who in the CIA. Now, there are links of Jimmy Carter, as well as Gerald Ford, and Robert Dole, and Fritz Mondale to the Lockheed Corporation. And I think this is important because Lockheed equals Hughes equals the CIA. And if all four of these men have links to Lockheed and to the CIA and to the Hughes organization, then it's a deck of cards. It's like shuffling them up and having a couple of aces and a couple of kings in the same suit. And there's no indication to me that Jimmy Carter isn't from the same fabric. And one reason I mentioned this is not only the Hughes money going to Mondale through Hubert Humphrey, but Wayne Andreas is a gentleman whose name came out at the time of Watergate. He had money in the bank of Bernard Barker and was funding the men at Watergate, and this money had passed hands at a golf course in Florida and ended up part of the Dirty Tricks. Well, Wayne Andreas has been a big source of funds to Andrew Young from Georgia, the same congressman I was talking about earlier. And Andrew Young disperses it to members of Congress and also to Jimmy Carter. Now, they claim that this money from Wayne Andreas isn't dirty or isn't tainted because even though it ended up at the time of the Watergate burglaries, it wasn't used for what he intended, that he didn't know that it was going to be used. But I take issue with that because I don't think people hand out money on a golf course or in checks in the hands of people known to be working for the intelligence community and not take some responsibility, particularly since he wasn't investigated and it was all up and he wasn't cleared. Also, there's reports that Jimmy Carter took trips to Latin America and to promote the Lockheed plane, the C-140. And the Lockheed organization has statements in the newspaper that Lockheed is the biggest industry in Georgia. Well, Jimmy Carter was the governor of Georgia, and Lockheed is the biggest industry in Georgia. Then I can't split hairs about the Howard Hughes organization, Lockheed, and the CIA, because I feel they are one and have been one since the earliest days, long before the U-2 flights, but constantly they've been hand in glove. And this is why Lockheed can't go bankrupt, and Congress supports them and bails them out, because they are a branch of the intelligence community and have to keep their agents functioning so that the CIA itself doesn't get caught. If Lockheed is the biggest industry in Georgia and it's involved in government scandals and payoffs into the millions in Japan and Holland, and if Carter and Mondale are selected by the Trilateral Commission to be president and vice president of the United States, with the other two countries being Japan and Prince Bernard's Holland, you have a bad situation. It's hard to separate who they really represent, and particularly with Carter's military background. Carter was a graduate of Annapolis in Navy intelligence, atomic warfare. He left there to do peanut farming for a while and then took Amy in front of the White House, his little daughter, and said that someday he'd be president of the United States. Ford went to modeling school, the same modeling school that Candy Jones went to when she became an agent for the CIA, so we don't know what went on at this modeling school. He went to Yale University. He was in the military, Navy. He's represented the CIA in Congress and on the Warren Commission. So for all purposes, you have two presidents that have strong links to Navy intelligence. There's an interesting article in the Washington Post, August 31st, 1976, that I'll briefly mention, and I give you the date because you may want to look it up. It's called That Now Famous Class of 1947. This was the graduating class of Annapolis in 1947. That was the year that the CIA was formed, including Reinhard Gehlen from Nazi intelligence. Out of this class in 1947, Jimmy Carter was 59th of a group of 494 graduates. From there came 32 admirals and two generals, a vice admiral, a general in the Marine Corps. One of the graduates became an admiral in Peru, and one is the chief of Navy operations in Venezuela. Carter and nearly half of his class left before serving 10 years. One of his classmates is vice president of Martin Marietta Corporation, a $2 billion corporation. Another one is vice president of Westinghouse. One of his classmates is vice president for financial affairs at the University of Pennsylvania. I just spent the weekend adding up the millions of dollars the University of Pennsylvania received from the CIA and the Pentagon from Fort Detrick, Maryland, to do mind testing, electrode implants, and using LSD and various drugs and combinations of chemicals. And the large grant of that, the bulk of it, went through the University of Pennsylvania. So you take the hunk of where the money went for these perilous experimentations in the universities, and you have to ask yourself, if it was under the auspices of the military and the CIA, how much did this financial affairs advisor for the University of Pennsylvania know? He's vice president there now, and what are his relationships to Jimmy Carter? Another classmate was Richard Goering, who's vice president for aerospace and defense at Sperry Rand. And among his classmates, there's 250 businessmen, 32 college teachers, 16 secondary educators, and 60 members of his class are dead. And then I've mentioned before in KLRB, 50 of them are ghosts. They completely disappeared. They can't be traced by the alumni. So out of this huge batch of people that the taxpayers spent to educate, to put through Annapolis, to serve in the Navy, Jimmy Carter has a whole bunch of interesting classmates. And I wonder how many contacts he has kept up with these people, say, Westinghouse, the University of Pennsylvania, at Sperry Rand, and Peruvian admiral in Venezuela. What contacts does Jimmy Carter have? How deep does the root go from Navy intelligence to the White House? And what kind of tentacles do we have that continue where the last presidency leaves off, just in case Jimmy Carter wins? Because, as I say, you can run off a list of 77 military dictatorships now. And how did they happen? Who are the classmates, such as Mr. Somoza, Nicaragua, was a graduate of West Point, and runs and owns the entire country. His son controls it now. The only airline and all the minerals and the labor and the banks run by the Somoza family, which is identical, again, to the Hughes Lockheed Corporation, who've had the controlling interest over there in Nicaragua. So what are the tentacles of Jimmy Carter to Annapolis? And I wonder, because I look at his classmates and I look at what is referred to as a warfare state, and I say, is it any better to have Gerald Ford, who graduated from Yale, or Jimmy Carter, who graduated from Annapolis? We do have an interesting election here in California of senators. I'll go back to the presidential matter in a minute, but I do want to mention briefly that Mr. Sam Hayakawa is running as the Republican here. And, of course, if he wins, that affects all the other 49 states. And running against him is Mr. Tunney, who's been in the Senate for quite a while, for the last few years. Charles McCabe wrote in the San Francisco Chronicle this week that the election between these two men is a disaster. He said Sam Hayakawa was a Japanese citizen who couldn't become a citizen until 1953 with absolutely no discernible qualities for the job, who may end up a U.S. senator. And John Tunney is a man who'd probably be selling insurance in a Connecticut suburb if he didn't have a father who knocked out Jack Dempsey twice in a box fight a half a century ago. He claims Tunney's been overemployed for a long, long time, and that this aging, courteous Mr. Hayakawa has no qualifications for the job. Also, Mr. Hayakawa, who's running for the Senate, came out just recently and said that the internment of Japanese in California in the internment camps during World War II was a good thing. Hayakawa was safe. He was living in Canada at the time. But he said it was good for the Japanese because it broke up their old family patterns. Living in Carmel, there are some Japanese families here that wouldn't agree with Mr. Hayakawa that it was good for them at all. They were taken away one day or evening and lost all their property, their homes, personal belongings. Hayakawa admitted that about 20% of the people that were interned objected to what happened. But I believe that about only 2% of the Germans objected to ovens and concentration camps in Germany, but that didn't make it right. So running for Congress as a Republican is a man who says that putting all the Japanese citizens into internment camps was good for them, and he's Japanese besides. And so that the choice here, if you project this to all the other states and elections coming up, I just hope that you don't have this kind of a choice to make in your states. I think it's pitiful that this is what we've come to, and I think the entire election board across the board when I read the newspapers is pretty sad. Well, I'm almost out of time. I want to talk about Mr. Solzhenitsyn. He's the darling of the Pentagon. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the Russian who moved to America, who is funded by Stanford Research and the Pentagon. He just built a home in Vermont with barbed wire. He's putting $250,000 into the renovations, and he bought a home for $150,000. He's put into a financial condition where he can go around and lecture and accrue huge fortune speaking for the Pentagon and the Defense Intelligence Agency. And running against him as the advisor of foreign affairs is Mr. Brzezinski, the darling of Jimmy Carter. He's the advisor for Henry Kissinger and James Schlesinger and David Rockefeller, and he's the counterpart of Solzhenitsyn. So that we don't really have a choice in this matter, that Mr. Brzezinski is a white Russian, very strongly against the Soviet Union, and I think that these people want to avenge the fact that they've lived here, even though they're making a lot of money and they're renowned in their community. They would like to get vengeance and go back and resurrect the Tsar if they could. So that the foreign policy coming from an expatriate like Brzezinski on the Jimmy Carter campaign, to me, is as dangerous as being Frank Sturgis as vice president with his anti-Castro Cuban feelings about Cuba. I think that these people have been selected, the documents show it, by the Rockefellers, the Bilderbergers, and put into office. Well, this is a dismal picture. That's a little bit about how I feel about the campaigns. I don't like it, but I told you last week we'd talk about it, and you can mull over it and read what you want on it. I will vote, but I don't like the candidates, and that's all I can say about it. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California, Dialogue Conspiracy. I'll be with you next Monday, and until then, take care and study your candidates and see which one you like.
This has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for many years has been researching the facts behind political assassinations and conspiracies in this country. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KLRB-FM in Carmel, California.